This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Get on your bike, sit on the seat, put your feet on the pedals, and ride it all around, ride it all around.
The buzz these days is greening big cities. New York rediscovers eco-density, while West Coast mayors vie for the title of most green. But North Americans don't live in big cities. The vast majority live in suburbs or just beyond in the exurbs, the land of many estates and three bay garages. I learned that and much more about the real struggle of car dependency and sustainability in America from Warren Carlinzig. He's the author of How Green Is Your City? The Sustain Lane U.S. City Rankings. Carlinzig is a recognized figure in California sustainability and the movement, an advisor to governments and big corporations, and a media spokesman. He's the president of Common Current and a fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, which hosted the speech we're about to hear. In October 2009, Vancouver, Canada hosted the conference Gaining Ground, Resilient Cities. The Post Carbon Institute organized an evening with Warren Carlinzig, along with authors Daniel Lurch and Bill Rees. From Urban Resilience in a Post-Carbon World, here is Warren Carlinzig, recorded October 20th by Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much, Daniel. Thanks, Bill. And I'll have to admit, I'm up here from California, and I was scouting out your glaciers today and figuring, you know, how we can maybe put them on a barge and tow them down. Have you heard about that plan before? That was an actual plan. I was up in Alaska. They were talking about doing that, California, at one point. It's going to come to something like that, seriously. Really glad to be here. Glad to see an event dedicated to resilient cities. And hopefully this gets people thinking about things in a new way and not just repackaging sustainability or planning or, you know, their background, but really mixes up the disciplines. As Daniel mentioned, I've been working with a lot of governments and my firm Common Current. And one particular conversation we're having lately, it's not with a client yet, but it's there are intermediaries, but the nation of China is trying to plan 40 eco-cities right now. And what they're doing is coming up with metrics around the design of cities that will hold from 400 to 800 million people by 2020 to 2040. And Asia is going to be responsible by 2020, Asian cities, for more than half of the greenhouse gases in the world that are going to increase between now and 2020. So more than half of the increase between now and 2020 in greenhouse gases are going to be caused by Asian cities. Now, here's the big problem. There's no real regulation around cities in the world today, but luckily China is looking at indicators. And one of the things they're interested in the most is resilience right now. They said, we've looked at energy efficiency and energy and carbon and, you know, with all these groups, the Clinton Climate Initiative, et cetera, the climate group. But we're really interested in earthquake risk, water, and basically resiliency. We'll start with looking at older cities as... What I'm going to do with this presentation is take one lens of urban resiliency, basically land use planning and transportation, a little bit of water at the end, and then have some solutions where some of these solutions are being implemented and where you could see and experience these things right now. Dense walkable centers, culture, jobs, parks, regional food markets, residential neighborhoods, easily accessible by foot, bike, and public transit. We all know that. I mean, everyone here, that's the mantra. And there's good reason that exurban sprawl, the U.S.-based model, which is being exported heavily around the world, including to places like China and Asian cities, is probably the worst model for resiliency. It has low density, poor or undefined centers, unconnected streets, few sidewalks, cul-de-sacs, separate businesses or business, commercial, and residential districts, accessible by car only. It's zoned that way. It's set up just for cars. But here's something that isn't studied too much or known by many outside the field is the high CO2 output of the suburbs. It's not just from the tailpipe emissions. It's the built environment itself is extremely poor in terms of water and energy efficiency. All those lawns you're looking at there, I mean, there's not a fruit tree or vegetable growing there. There are no sidewalks for those houses. Those people are prisoners of a car. And the irony is that in the United States, you think urban resiliency, big cities, great model. But big cities constitute only 20% of the total population of the U.S., about 15% is rural, The rest of it is in suburbs and exurbs, around 60%, 65% of 100,000 or smaller. So if we're not seeing suburban or exurban case studies here at an event like this, we're not addressing the problem in the U.S. at least, and I know there's a lot of it in Canada as well. So as we all well know, we're running out of cheap oil. Whether we're running out of oil or not, we'll find out in our lifetimes, I'm sure. But this is the CEO of Shell, said this last year. This was in an email to his staff. By 2015, growth in the production of easily accessible oil and gas will not match the projected rate of demand growth, and that remaining within desirable levels of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, at 350 level, will become increasingly difficult. Oil supplies, our economy is extremely vulnerable. In 1970 in the U.S., we imported a third of our oil. In 2008, we imported two-thirds, a good deal of that from Canada, actually. And before you feel smug about Canada's situation with oil, I've got a slide or two for you. The U.S. is extremely vulnerable to supply disruptions from the Middle East, Nigeria, Russia, et cetera, and from natural disasters. Like last year, a hurricane hit, and it took out the oil supply to the southeast. Atlanta, Charlotte, and Knoxville, major cities, were without gasoline on many days in many parts of those areas for about 3 to 6 weeks. So in Canada, the vulnerability is in the eastern provinces. They are the most vulnerable. Just like the southeast of the United States, there are only one or two pipelines to get oil to most of the major cities. They also rely on tanker trucks that burn oil to bring oil. And the nation is moving to high-carbon oil sands, formerly called tar sands. I don't know when the name changed. Maybe the oil companies like the oil sands better. But the decrease in conventional oil in Canada is going to be about 35% between 2008 and 2020. The increase from oil sand production is forecast to be 56% by 2020. I've actually read that it's the biggest growth area for the entire Canadian economy. Why is that a problem? Well, conservative estimates are that three times the amount of greenhouse gases are created by the production of oil sands compared to conventional oil. Some estimates say five times as much. There's also the issue of water use and contamination from the mining of these sands, natural gas use to process them. And the peat layer, this is new research showing that the peat layer that's going to be disrupted by mining these tar sands can release amounts of methane beyond what we are prepared to deal with in terms of global climate change. Exponential increases in methane, which is a far more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. So I'm going to show you the results of a mini study I put out last year looking at U.S. city preparedness for an oil crisis. And this is different than the sustained lane rankings, which covered more water and management and a number of other areas. This was just looking at oil vulnerability. The best prepared cities had public transit, they had telecommuting, they had walkability, they had bikeability. And what I did was aggregated the rates of use of those particular modes of transit in the cities. And these were the top 10 cities. And luckily, Seattle is ranked high, and Portland, the Northwest, is doing relatively well. And the poor cities, the cities that are going to absolutely be left hanging on a edge of a cliff if oil goes above its 147 barrel price again, or there's supply disruptions, are almost completely dependent on automobiles for everything in their economy. Transportation, for getting to jobs, for moving goods. Oklahoma City, the center of a lot of the oil and gas industry, is number one. And the mayor of Oklahoma City even said to me once, well, if it ever happens that the car is not something that, you know, we can depend on as a major part of our lives, then we're screwed, basically. I admit that. So, and the other issue here is that we're looking at sprawl. That was one factor in this ranking. So sprawl means that even if you do have a hybrid car, it doesn't get you out of it. You know, you still need the infrastructure, the roads to drive that car on. You still need all the maintenance of those roads, which are made out of asphalt. Daniel's done some great research in that area, actually. The rise in asphalt, like last year when oil prices went high, it went up, you know, 300, 400%. this ranking was based on these factors, the ones I mentioned, telecommuting, overall metro area, public transit use. And this is just one way of grouping data. You could do this in many ways for different cities for different purposes. These are some of the figures on U.S. resident commute rates by public transit in 2007. You see New York City is far ahead of other cities. It's dense. It has a historic system. Hong Kong is at about 87. Actually, I've read even over 90% now. 90% of people use it to commute. And then you have cities like Arlington, Texas, which you've probably never heard of, except that it's the home of the Dallas Cowboys and the Texas baseball team. They have absolutely no public transit, zero walkability, zero bikeability. It's a city of 330,000. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of cities like this in the United States with absolutely zero public transit, zero walkability, statistically zero bikeability. If oil goes up, and this happened in some of these cities, I've talked to folks that if you're working a part-time job and you're driving, you're barely making it, there's no way to find a job, let alone to get the work and to pay to do that. And that's what caused one of the main crashes in our economy. Here's a look at walking and biking together stats. Boston leads the U.S., 14%. Oklahoma City, 1.1% people walking and biking on an aggregate basis. But 14% is pretty substantial.
Progressive Radio, Green 960 AM, San Francisco. This is Radio EcoShock. We are listening to a speech by Warren Karlenzig in Vancouver, Canada on October 20th. This is part of a panel on urban resilience in a post-carbon world.
Now, there are other metrics you can use for urban resiliency. Farmers markets, community gardens, schools, and restaurants using regional food per capita. Some are easy to come by, some are harder. For the How Green Is Your City study, for the first time, I ranked farmers markets and community gardens per capita. No one had done it before. You know, there's a lot of ways you could look at information and data out there to prepare your city or your region for what is to come. Preservation of local regional farmland, fisheries, water conservation, and water recycling. You know, cities are starting to do some of these things now. Renewable energy percent of total energy supply. Again, no one ever looked at that. Of the largest 50 cities in the U.S., you know, that they didn't know that one city had 15% of its energy coming from renewables and many others had zero. This is all leading to what went down over the past 2 years, and that is the beginning of an economic crisis, the sprawl, the lack of public transit, the reliance on automobiles as the only form of transportation, and the only really way of life where all structures and all civilization is built to accommodate the car and movement by the car. What happened was that sprawl became the highest risk in real estate value from 2007 to 2008. And no one guessed this would happen except, you know, Mr. Kunstler and a few others out there. But, you know, planning has gone on for a long time with talk about smart growth, and there's good reason for it. But now the economics are coming in where we could see that close-in neighborhoods, some of them even went up in Portland and Pittsburgh, places served by transit, walkability, bikeability, density, during this period, 2007 to 2008, where the distant neighborhoods went down substantially, some ridiculous amounts. There's an article here that Post Carbon Institute is going to print, research I did at Empty Houses in the Desert, American Suburbanization Meets the Resource Crisis of the 21st Century, and it profiles a town, Victorville, California. You've never heard of it, but it's 110,000, and its real estate values went from 360 on average in 2007 to this year about 120,000. So it's just becoming abandoned. They're tearing down new houses, perfectly good McMansions. Here's a profile of Washington, D.C., the metro area, one of the best areas in the United States for public transit and walkability and bikeability. You could see in the central corridor the values between 2006 and 2007 held up. You see the 3% gain on the right in that inner core, and that's the D.C., that little square, the District of Columbia. The red zone went down some, you know, 3%, not a huge drop, but the outer suburban areas dropped 26%. So that was what sprawl looks like when it hits loss of confidence in the American public and it crashes. And I personally don't think a lot of it will ever come back again, especially as we get into climate change regulations and climate change adaptation. California has started a global greenhouse gas law called AB 32 to reduce greenhouse gases by 2050. And out of that, Senate Bill 375 was spawned. And this is the first statewide anti-sprawl bill in the United States. The details are coming out right now, but it's going to require that development of housing closer to transit and jobs. And there's great hope that this will actually start to address sprawl on a statewide basis, because the state knows that it's running out of energy to power these homes with air conditioners. You know, it's 100 degrees on the average day in Victorville in July. 100 degrees, what is that, 34, 35 Celsius? That's the average temperature. There's no water. It rains less than 5 inches a year there. Yet their population increased from 60,000 in 2000 to 107,000 last year. It almost doubled. And that's going on all over places like Phoenix, Florida, Southern California. So now we're onto the solution track. LEED ND, you've heard some about today. There was a session on that, LEED for Neighborhood Development, which is wonderful because it actually allows cities or neighborhoods or developments to look at multiple factors besides just green building. They look at location efficiency, locations closer to existing towns and city centers. With each building, there are cars in the driveway. Remember that, and that's what LEED ND addresses. Vancouver is a great model in many ways. It's getting better all the time. As a walker's paradise, this is a tool called walkscore.com. And I knew people last year in California that wouldn't consider a job or buying a home or renting an apartment if something didn't have at least a 50 or 60 rating on walkscore.com. You're going to see tools like this become way more mainstream. You know, people are not just going to go, oh, does it have, you know, shag carpeting, or, you know, does it have a view? They're going to say, how am I going to be able to afford this? Or do I really want to live like this? This is great because it has, you know, cinemas, parks, libraries, bookstores, fitness centers, even taverns, all within 1 kilometer. And here is one slide on water issue. I didn't get into that lens with this presentation today. I could have. With climate change, melting snowpack is a huge issue. Snowpack starts melting sooner and sooner during the year, particularly in the Sierra, which Bill alluded to. We might not be able to have agriculture down there much longer. So, you know, the land up here is going to become far more valuable for agriculture in the Fraser Valley and a lot of places in BC. It's 20 days earlier the snow is melting. That's massive, particularly when you have, you know, cities of 10 million like Los Angeles depending entirely on snowpack for their water almost. They have a little aquifer water. And if it's not around, there's no other choice. And it's all over the West. The Southwest is, Mr. Kunstler would say, toast. By 2025, Lake Mead is forecast 50% chance of being completely dry for water storage. Lake Mead supplies 90% of the water for Las Vegas and a good deal of water for Phoenix and Los Angeles. It might be dry by early as 2021, actually. So the Southwest is, you know, we're going to have to rethink that one. So what can we do? You know, in our home, when we heat water up for shaving or a shower, we just put a bucket under the faucet. You don't even have to put it in the bathtub. And you get enough to flush the toilet, like, many times a day. I calculate it saves us between 1 and 2,000 gallons of water a year. And I have my kids, they know how to do it now. They're like 10 years old, and at first they thought it was really weird, and now they think it's cool. You know, that's 1 to 2,000 gallons of water. Now let's look at mobility a little. This is San Francisco's Sunday Streets program. Of course, the merchants said it was going to kill their business, but now they're finding that it increased their business by hundreds of percent for most businesses, because it brings people into the city, actually, or it makes residents go out that wouldn't go out on their bikes or know about that business. This is called the parking to pavement program in San Francisco, where parking space for cars is rented out by different groups, and then they create livable space out of it, cafe space, art space, space just to hang out that's car-free. This will be very important as the transition of moving away from the automobile as the dominant mode of life, is that you have to create spaces that are car-free completely. And I have two cars myself. I'm not anti-car, but it's just we're going to have to get used to these ideas. New York City, Broadway, bringing people out in the neighborhood, get to know one another in an open space. And fabulous experiment and highly successful. Again, increased business for all these shops up and down Broadway who all tried to fight it at first. Portland, it has free public transit. I don't know if anyone, you know, most of you have probably been there, but this blows away people when you go to New York or Chicago and say, it's all free. See that Fairless Square? You just jump on any train, you could ride it for free. And they take your bicycle at any time of day. It has a huge, huge advantage versus other cities where they say, yes, we allow bicycles, you know, if it's pouring rain, but not during rush hour. San Francisco on the BART system. I think maybe they're changing that. Here's a free ferry for bicycles and small motorized vehicles in Amsterdam, which has a 50% commute by bicycle rate in the downtown district. I went there, this is from last year, and it's like Disneyland for cyclists. You see like 50 bikes for every car on a Sunday down there. It's unbelievable. This is from San Francisco near the ferry building. It has 72% diversion of solid waste now and the largest urban industrial composting program. All the food scraps from the city go to a composting facility outside the city, and it's used for vineyards in the Napa Valley and Sonoma Valley. And kids are the ones that train people to recognize where they're supposed to put things. So it's a program for high schoolers. They're trying to go to zero waste, too, by the way, in San Francisco by 2020 is their goal. This is Paris's Valib program. There are now 100,000 rides or more. I mean, that was like a year and a half ago, a day, on these rental bikes. You swipe a credit card, you ride it, and you put it back. There's a couple hundred stations around the city now. It's changed life in Paris, not just to make it easy for people to commute on bikes, but people actually go to Paris just to ride bikes now. They have running lights. They're great for night. This is Hanoi, 2003. This is not a car-free city or a car-free street. This is just how people have traditionally lived there. In fact, in terms of resilience, the bicycle was one of the most important tools that helped the Vietnamese defeat the Americans in the so-called American War, as they call it. We call it the Vietnam War. Bicycles were used on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They were the main source of carrying supplies, food, ammunition, people, etc. And you still see bicycles used at construction sites, building high-rises sometimes, carrying pipes, beams. You cannot believe what a bicycle can do until you go to Vietnam. Finally, we just need to, of course, educate kids, get them. I mean, they understand this. They know climate change is here. They know things are different with resources. They were the ones that really led the recycling movement in the U.S. that trained parents. Don't throw that out. You know, just put it here like we do in our class. We are basically at a moment in which we can either live in denial or we can seize a rare opportunity where our collective decisions and actions can help design a purposeful future. It's not going to be easy, but some of the change is already underway, as I've shown you. And the true beauty of witnessing blossoming is in the observation of the new growth, the buds, shoots, and the expectation or preparation for the blooming that's to come. Thank you very much.
That was Warren Karlenzig on Urban Resilience in a Post-Carbon World, a shoulder event to the Resilient Cities Conference in Vancouver, Canada. This talk and the complete evening organized by the Post-Carbon Institute will be posted shortly as free MP3s in the Cities section at ecoshock.org. Look for our audio on demand menu on the main page. Find out more about Warren Karlenzig at commoncurrent.com or Greenflow on Twitter. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening.